Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Raise your hand if you thought subprime loans were a thing of the past. Now go ahead and put them right back down again, because General Motors, of which you, me, and our neighbors own 60%, announced today it's back into subprime financing in a very big way. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, monitoring, protecting, and helping improve your online reputation while deleting personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com/market. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you with us on this Thursday. It is the 22nd of July today. And from General Motors this morning came this news, that the once bankrupt, then bailed out, and now recovering automaker is getting back into the car loan business. GM is going to buy an auto financing company called AmeriCredit for $3.5 billion. GM, obviously, wants to sell more cars. AmeriCredit lends to people who might not usually qualify for a loan to buy those cars. They are a category broadly known as subprime borrowers, and Marketplace's Elisa Roth reminds us that they are still where the money's to be made.
GM is hoping the deal will get more subprime borrowers to buy its vehicles. And GM's not the only one courting buyers with less than perfect credit. Still, we aren't back in 2006, when a pulse was all you needed to get a loan for a house or a car or just to go shopping. Chris Kukla is at the Center for Responsible Lending. He says a lot fewer places are lending money to people with poor credit.
Most of the mainstream institutions have moved away from serving subprime customers because it's perceived as being too risky. They don't want to go out to their investors and their shareholders and say, we're doubling down on subprime.
He says the field is wide open for places that do still want to offer loans to people with poor credit. One recent study showed the number of credit card offers made to subprime borrowers doubled this year. Another says subprime loans still make up 40% of the car loan market. He says there's plenty of money to be made.
If there's a couple of people who are willing to lend, believe me, they're going to lend it to you. It's going to come at a very dear price because now, your options are limited.
Borrowers might not know that, though. He says subprime loans are often less transparent than prime ones, where you can easily go online and find out what it should cost. The new Consumer Protection Bureau could change that, though at least in the case of car loans, it may not, since car dealers are exempt from its oversight and the final rules haven't actually been written yet. Robert Lawless is a law professor at the University of Illinois, and he says the biggest moneymakers have always been the marginal borrower, the one who has enough money to keep making payments some of the time.
They're making their money off the back end about when these people aren't able to make a monthly payment and then get hit with a fee or the interest rate changes because of the missed payment.
He says those borrowers may default more often, but the higher interest rates and big fees more than make up for that risk. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
The Senate has given up, for the moment anyway, on a comprehensive climate change bill. Majority Leader Harry Reid said today he's going to bring a straight-ahead energy bill to the floor next week. Offshore drilling reform, efficiency programs, all that kind of stuff. Cap and trade and alternative energy, Reid said, is going to have to wait until after the fall elections. You mentioned U.S. government bonds, and most people think of two things, that they're a good place to earn slow but steady income, and that they're a good place to be when the economy looks rough. Now, think of this for me, would you? Investors have been buying treasuries like they are going out of style. Which brings us to another thing about these bonds. They are often an indicator of the way the economy could go. So does the bond market know something we don't? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
The rule on Wall Street has been when investors start buying treasury bonds in a big way, look out. They're betting the economy could go sour. So is that what's happening now? Mark Vintner says no. He's senior economist at Wells Fargo. He says investors are just jittery, and they're looking for safety in the arms of Uncle Sam.
Growth has weakened over the last few weeks from whatever it did in the second quarter, and people are now a little more concerned.
Recent readings on retail sales and housing haven't been so great. But economist Ellen Zentner of the Bank of Tokyo says there's something else at play here. People are buying bonds as a way of protecting themselves from the ups and downs of the stock market.
As soon as we wring volatility out of the financial markets, I think investors will realize that the corporate balance sheets look very good. They're in good shape.
When the economy improves, investors don't need the safety of bonds. Conrad DiQuadros is an economist at RDQ Economics. He doesn't believe in the bond buyer barometer. He says it may have worked a decade ago, but it's a little off these days because foreigners are buying our bonds regardless of U.S. economic trends.
The fact that they are much more significant purchasers of Treasury securities makes the Treasury market less indicative of what investors believe the outlook for growth and inflation is.
So no more following the bond buyers. Listen to economists Vintner, Zentner, and DiQuadros. They all expect the economy to keep growing. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The market rally today was largely driven by healthy corporate profit reports, UPS and Caterpillar in particular. Companies are under enormous pressure to meet Wall Street's expectations, often down to the very penny per share, even when the economy is shaky. That helps explain the announcement from the Securities and Exchange Commission about Dell Computers today. The company is going to pay $100 million to settle charges of accounting fraud, fraud directly related to meeting Wall Street's profit targets. Founder Michael Dell is going to pay a $4 million civil penalty out of his own pocket as well. AT&T beat the street with its quarterly profits this morning, up 26% on a boom in new iPhone users the past 3 months. Great for the company, maybe not so great for users of AT&T's data network. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Verizon may not have the iPhone, but for years its marketing made the case that it has a better mobile network.
No other wireless carrier has more 3G coverage than Big Red.
But Andy Hargraves with Pacific Crest Securities says soon Verizon's Big Red network might not be enough.
You have bandwidth demand accelerating at a pace that they can't keep up with.
According to Verizon Executive, customers who buy the new Google Droid phone use 5 times more data than other smartphone owners on their system. And that spells trouble.
You can make a very, very good case that the network is broken.
Or will be soon. And Hargrave says Verizon's problem isn't unique. The next generation of smartphones could cripple wireless networks.
The network, as it's built right now, just won't support what people are trying to do with it.
The average iPhone user sucks down 10 to 15 times more bandwidth on AT&T's wireless network than a conventional mobile phone customer. iPhone owners use more than twice as much network space as someone on, say, a BlackBerry. That means the 3 million new iPhone users AT&T signed up last quarter create a strain on the system that's roughly equal to adding Cairo or New York City to their network.
There'll always have to be management of what people are going to do. We can't all watch HDTV on our mobile phone.
Glenn Fleischman runs Wi-Fi Networking News. He says despite spending billions over the past 3 years on upgrades, AT&T can't keep up. So
you can make it more expensive for people to consume data.
And that's exactly what AT&T did. And right now, rumors are rampant. Verizon's likely to follow suit by the end of this month. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Forget all that silly talk from Ben Bernanke yesterday about the economy being unusually uncertain. We got corporate profits, baby. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The promise of personalized genetic testing is actually pretty interesting. You take a swab of the inside of your cheek, you mail it in, and for a couple of $100, you learn your risk of cancer or heart disease. Oh, if only it worked out that way. A report by the Government Accountability Office says those do-it-yourself tests aren't really much good. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner reports.
Government investigators sent the same saliva samples to 4 well-known genetic testing companies. The result? One donor was told that his risk of prostate cancer was below average, average, and above average. The investigators also posed as customers and called the companies. No undercover sting operation would be complete without a muffled wiretap.
So if I'm high risk, does that mean I'll definitely get breast cancer?
You would be in the high risk of, pretty much getting it, so.
The company rep tells the woman she is likely to get breast cancer.
There's no clinical validity for these tests.
Harry Osterer is director of the Human Genetics Program at NYU. He believes geneticists will have this power of prediction soon, but the science isn't there yet.
They're trying to do it prematurely, and they're saying, we're empowering consumers, and you can trust us.
All the personalized genetic testing companies say that their results are for educational and recreational use only. The GAO didn't name the companies they investigated, but they said some of the companies even told customers they could sell them a personalized pill to repair their damaged DNA. Today, representatives from three companies, 23andMe, Navigenics, and Pathway Genomics Corporation, testified before Congress. Analysts say the government could slap warning labels on the tests and even ban some tests from being sold online.
The economics of this particular industry just changed dramatically.
Jim Pruto is a consultant to genetic testing companies. He says these companies take just a few months to get up and running. New federal regulations could delay that to years. He said many of the small companies selling these tests don't have the deep pockets to last that long. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Twenty years ago this coming Monday, July of 1990, President George H.W. Bush signed the Americans with Disabilities Act into law. Not overnight, but in the years that followed, parts of society that had been off limits were opened up to people living with disabilities. Part of the reason that process was so slow was in trying to figure out who was going to pay for the changes. In the public sector, anyway, it was mostly cities and states, not the feds. That's especially true for public transportation, which in many ways is still struggling to adapt to an ADA world. From WAMU in Washington, D.C., David Schultz reports.
Ed McEntee is waiting for a van. He's in the lobby of the office building where he works, sitting in his motorized wheelchair.
I had polio when I was 8 years old. Right now I'm 66, so I've been in the wheelchair for roughly 58 years.
He's waiting on Metro Access, a service D.C.'s local public transit agency created specifically to comply with the Americans with Disabilities Act. Metro Access consists of wheelchair-accessible vans and taxis that provide door-to-door service for people with disabilities. McEntee scheduled a van to be here a half hour ago, but it's not, so he calls their dispatch center.
If you have a trip scheduled for today and would like to check on your ride, press 2.
McEntee says delays like this are all too common.
I usually joke, but it's not some joking matter, really, that there's at least one nightmare a week, and one never knows when that nightmare is going to happen.
When it does, he says, the waits can stretch on for hours. Despite this, McEntee rides Metro Access every day, along with a rapidly growing number of others. Christian Kent is the general manager of Metro Access. He says his service has grown by 20% every year for the past 4 years.
It's not so much that people are using the service more, it's that more people are using the service.
And as a result, in the past decade, the cost of operating Metro Access quadrupled. DC's transit agency responded earlier this year by cutting Metro Access service and raising fares.
This is a national trend. People are living longer, and that, you know, with modern advances in medicine, and as that trend continues, there are more and more people that are going to rely on these types of services.
But these federally mandated services are becoming more and more expensive. From 2004 to 2008, the nationwide cost of providing transit to people with disabilities doubled to nearly $5 billion.
Any transit agency, publicly funded transit agency, has to provide this comparable service to people who aren't able to use the bus and rail.
That's Wendy Cloncher, a planner with the Washington area's Transportation Planning Board who works on accessibility issues. She says requiring transit agencies to provide this service puts them at odds with the customers they're supposed to be serving.
The transit agency tends to have concerns about the escalating costs. The disability community tends to have issues with the service quality, and it's not easy anywhere.
Meanwhile, back at Ed McEntee's office, a Metro Access van has finally arrived, almost an hour and a half late. Despite this delay, the most recent of many, McEntee will continue to take Metro Access. He has no other option.
In order to sit there and be a viable human being in society, you have to be able to get from point A to point B. And that's all there is.
McEntee certainly doesn't want to go back to the days before Metro Access, when he had to rely solely on his family to drive him around. But McEntee says if his wheelchair didn't prevent him from getting to the bus stop, he'd quit riding Metro Access tomorrow. From Washington, D.C., I'm David Schultz for Marketplace.
Coming up, high-end wines head to the bargain bin.
$6.99 represents an extremely, you know, we had to sell it far below what we had in it just to get the inventory gone.
But first, let's do the numbers. Strong earnings reports from some economic bellwethers kicked stocks into high gear today, hence the really happy music. The Dow Industrials rocketed 201 points higher. That's 2%, closed at 10,322. The NASDAQ picked up 58 points, more than 2 2/3%, 2245, the number you're looking for there. The S&P 500 tacked on 24 points, 2.25%, closed at 1,093. Among the stocks leading the charge was UPS. The world's biggest package delivery company posted earnings 90% better than it did a year ago. Investors saw that as a sign the economy is on the mend. Shares jumped more than 5% for Big Brown. Heavy equipment maker Caterpillar is also considered a litmus strip for the economy. Shares plowed forward more than 1.5% after the company posted better than expected earnings on $10 billion in revenue. Tape maker 3M stuck on more good news, reporting a 43% jump in its quarterly earnings. Investors boosted shares by nearly 3% there. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.93%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Vanguard, a client-owned company where the clients own the funds and the funds own the company. Learn more at Vanguard.com. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on podcasts. You'll find Marketplace, The Morning Report, Marketplace Money, and more, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The Labor Department releases data on mass layoffs for June. That's when 50 or more workers from a single employer lose their job. The Military Child Education Coalition wraps up its annual conference in Washington. Dr. Jill Biden speaks. And actor Daniel Radcliffe of Harry Potter fame can go from butterbeer to real beer. He turns 21. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We try real hard here on this program not to do the jargon thing. We figure the less we talk about stuff like inverted yield curves and synthetic CDOs, the better off that we and you are. The oil industry obviously doesn't feel the same way. Since the leak in the Gulf of Mexico started, we've all become familiar with terms like top kill and junk shot and so many more. Chrissy Clark is here to give us a brief history of all the new industry language that we've been learning. Hey, Chrissy.
Hi, Kai.
So I've got my list of favorites. Let's go to you, though. You're the one who's been doing the research. What do you like of all these terms that we've heard?
Oh, there are so many good ones. And it's not just around well containment, but oil drilling in general is just this kind of font of wonderful words. There's a guy who's worked in the oil industry for a long time named Nolan Hart, and he's put a list of his favorite terms together. It's a sort of glossary. I'm going to read you some of the greatest hits.
Okay.
So there's doghouse, fishing, possum belly, monkey board, and my favorite, doodle bugger, which is a guy who does seismic surveys in an oil field. They use this giant truck that sends big vibrations down into the earth. And here's Nolan explaining how that connects to doodle bugging.
There's a little animal called an ant lion. Some people call them doodle bugs in the South, and they flick out dirt, kind of vibrate their rear end and shake out dirt. And I think that's probably where the term doodle bugger might come from, is from shaking the earth. Shaking the ground.
Who comes up with these things? I mean, where do they come from?
Well, it's kind of human nature. I mean, anywhere you go where you have a bunch of people working together on one task, you're going to get jargon. And especially in Texas, you're going to get a lot of colorful mm-hmm. jargon. We've got the whole cowboy poetry mm-hmm. legacy. Nolan, the guy who made this glossary, thinks that there's also something about how dangerous work can be in an oil field, that people want to bring some levity to the place, kind of gallows humor. I also talked to Barbara Shook, who's a 40-year veteran in the oil industry herself. She had another theory about how these words get coined.
Well, in the old days, they might have been invented under the influence of spirits. People who go in the oil patch are different. They're a lot of fun. You should meet my Uncle Henry.
Did you talk to Uncle Henry?
I tried, but he's 90. But I did ask Barbara what her favorites were. She told me, but the FCC wouldn't let us broadcast them. But she laughs about them now, but she says that actually these words and this jargon is just sort of the tip of the iceberg. It reflects a pretty macho culture that she lived with.
I remember going to oil field conferences that had trade shows where the hookers staked out their turf in the exhibition halls. I just acted like I didn't know what was going on. This is how life has changed in the last 40 years.
It's not all off color, though. I mean, especially now. There's just some boring stuff, too, isn't there?
Yeah, of course. There's lots of boring old phrases. Lower Marine Riser Package, acronyms like ROV or Remotely Operated Vehicle. And in fact, a lot of the words that we hear, like Top Kill or Junk Shot, that we think are funny now, it's more that we have our radar kind of tuned into it. You know, these words would just go by if we didn't care so much about what's going on in this oil spill right now.
Yeah, because of the news. Speaking of which, the news is the storm that's coming up into the Gulf of Mexico, which leads us to the last phrase of our lesson here today, storm packer.
Yes, not to be confused with a storm trooper, but packer. I did some amateur etymological research of my own, and it turns out that this term first shows up in a citation in 1968 in the Journal of Petroleum Technology. I highly recommend that book. And they say, I quote, "A new application for the quick retrievable bridge plug is an offshore operation such as a storm packer in the event of an emergency requiring the well to be quickly secured."
As we have today. Chrissy Clark, also known as the William Sapphire of oil industry jargon. That was interesting. Chrissy, thanks a lot.
Thanks. I do my best.
There were times back in the depths of the financial crisis when all you wanted to do at the end of the day was go home and have a good stiff drink. Fact is that while the recession has been good for sales of hard spirits, wine has actually had a much rougher go. Since the economy went wrong, consumers don't want to pay for notes of blackberry and coffee and a good lingering finish. What they care most about is price, and winemakers who were unprepared for the demand shift have found themselves over a barrel. From North Carolina Public Radio, Janet Babin reports.
Tom Meyer never quite fit into corporate America. Once, during a strategy session at Fetzer Wines, he and other execs were asked to explain why the company was in business. Most said to make a profit. Meyer had a different take.
Yes, we're here to make a profit, but the profit's going to be the result of our good action. And I was gone within, 2 months after that.
With the day job gone, Meyer opened up two businesses back in 2003, a barbecue restaurant called the Q Shack and a wine brand called Sauvignon Republic.
Whether you're farming for wine or for hogs or for collard greens, farming is farming.
The pulled pork sandwiches really took off, and wine drinkers were happy to pay $19 a bottle for Sauvignon Republic in stores or even more in trendy restaurants. But these days, Meyer's wine is sharing shelf space with $2 Chuck at Trader Joe's. It sells for 70% off its original price.
$6.99 represents an extremely, we had to sell it far below what we had in it just to get the inventory gone.
Meyer needed to unload his inventory because the company collapsed. Many U.S. wineries will find themselves in Meyer's situation this year. Since the financial crisis, demand for pricey wine has gone the way of other luxuries. Those bottles of steakhouse cabernets aren't moving in restaurants or retail shops. And winemakers typically borrow the money they need for next year's vintage against last year's stash. Alder Yarrow writes the wine blog Vinography.com.
when people simply stop buying wine at most price points above $10, the real value of your inventory plummets. And as a result, banks stop lending money and really bad things happen.
Prominent California winemakers like Ross Valley Winery and Havens Wine Cellars have folded, and several more wineries are barely holding on. Peter Kaufman is managing director of Bacchus Capital, a company that funds winemakers.
The wineries that produce these sorts of wines have grown for so long and had planned for unending 10 to 15% annual growth, and then boom.
But there are small signs that the worst may be over. Wine importer Kermit Lynch has both a wholesale and retail business based in Berkeley. Kermit Lynch manager Steve Waters says when the recession hit, restaurants stopped buying wine, but the retail store was slow and steady. Now, Waters says the situation's reversed.
Our wholesale divisions in California and throughout the country have been on fire, 10 to 15% increase. So it seems like people are going out again, are going to restaurants, are buying wine off wine lists, which is great.
If the wine business does rebound, you can bet entrepreneurs like Tom Meyer of now-defunct Sauvignon Republic will be ready. After a tough year, his restaurant's holding on. And with the wine label, Meyer says he only missed the mark by a few million.
And I think had we had another, this is going to sound crazy, another $2 million, we would have gotten over the hump, made the wines we wanted to make, paid our bank notes. Life would have been great.
At least he can keep his glass half full of the wine he made for 70% off retail. In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering long-term strategies built on experience and research on the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, just to pick up on the conversation I had with Chrissy Clark a little bit ago about oil industry lingo. There's a huge spill that's spreading off the coast of northeast China. Two pipelines there exploded almost a week ago. It's not quite on the scale of the Gulf, about 400,000 gallons in the water so far. And the cleanup is decidedly more low-tech, and this is where the lingo comes in. The headline from the Washington Post website this afternoon reads like this: volunteers use chopsticks and rakes against the oil spill. So you use what you got, I guess. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media this Thursday afternoon. Today, the Dow pumped up 200 points, almost 2%. The NASDAQ up 58, more than 2.75%. The S&P 500 gained 24 points. That is 2.25%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune into the Marketplace Morning Report tomorrow for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up tomorrow afternoon on this broadcast, the winding economic history of the Colorado River.
The best way I could describe it was as a dust bowl. It reminded me of, you know, the old pictures I saw from the Farm Security Administration of just total agricultural collapse.
We'll talk pictures tomorrow. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.